Hare Krishna, nice to see everyone here. So we're discussing Canto 3, Chapter 20, particularly. We're going to have a look at... in essence, just to summarise, the sages at Naimisharanya asked Sudha Goswami to tell them a little bit more about the conversation between Maitreya and Vidura. They had been discussing, you know, after the creation of some of the Prajapatis and the four Kumaras, there was the pastime of Lord Varaha. So once, you know, the earth was situated back in its rightful place, how did those Prajapatis then, what did Lord Brahma do with regard to the Prajapatis in order to create the universe and the universal population? So in answer to that, there was a brief discussion on Sarga, or the initial creation of the universe, just in order to get, you know, a proper sequence of the steps, put everything into its context, just summarising creation that had been discussed before. And then he leads into secondary creation, and aspects of secondary creation were also discussed, but there is a different element of secondary creation here, in which some various types of personalities which haven't really been discussed at length appeared from the body of Lord Brahma. So, Hare Krishna Tirtha, nice to have you along. So, are you sitting in today? You're going to sit in weekly? Just when you can? Nice to have you. You were there in Bhakti Shastri for a little bit. That's good. All right, so let's have a look at that. Now, we'll start round about verse 18, I think it is. Would someone like to read out verse 18?
First of all, Brahma created from his shadow the coverings of ignorance of the conditioned souls. They are five in number and are called Tamistra, Andhatamistra, Tamas, Moha and Mahamoha.
Yes. Five different coverings of ignorance. Uh, So this will actually be an interesting unit for you to sit in on, Tirtha, because we've only really just begun. This is the first chapter. There's chapters 20 to 24. We're really looking at the first chapter properly today. At the end of having a brief look at these chapters, we're going to get each student to do an individual presentation. So it'd be very good experience. Okay. First of all, Brahma created from his shadow the coverings of ignorance of the conditioned souls. They're five in number and are called Tamisra, under Tamisra, Tamas, Moha, and Maha Moha. And might be handy to keep that chart. You have that chart on page 144. Do you have that one with you as well? Of your student handbook? Is there one in there? Yeah? 146?
Yes.
Okay. And we can get you a copy of the student handbook, Tirtha, if you wanted, the student handbook and Prabhupada's quotes for module one, if you want them. We printed extra, I think, didn't we? Yeah, so if you want a copy, yeah.
Maybe I'll see. I don't know what the next
six
will be like.
Yeah, yeah. So see how you go. If you do want them, we've got a copy, and being a brahmachari, I think the temple covers it anyway. So, you might as well grab one. You can get one off Bhakti Sar, right? Yeah. Some of these technical parts. It's sometimes good to look at the Burujan Prabhu's unveiling his lotus feet helps out, because there's little comments given by the acharyas which sometimes just help to get the essence of these things. I'll just read out something here from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. These are all created from Brahma's shadow. In his commentary, he says, in creating the yakshas, rakshasas, devatas, and humans, false identity must arise in the jivas. Without ignorance, this is not possible. So for them to identify with the bodies that they will inhabit, they have to be somewhat in ignorance of their original spiritual nature. So ignorance must be there. Therefore, the functions of ignorance appear on their own through Brahma. Tamas is the original form of ignorance. And this verse describes how Brahma created them by tamas, which took the form of a shadow. So in succession we've got tamas, moha, mahamoha, tamisra and under tamisra. Tamas, he defines it as ignorance. Moha is egotism. Mahamoha is attachment. Tamisra means hatred, and under tamisra means absorption in material pleasure. It's a very simple definitions there, but very accurate descriptions of the Sanskrit. So then, let's have a look at Srila Prabhupada's purport. And Prabhupada says, the first condition is a covering of tamisra or anger. So, constitutionally, each and every living entity has minute independence. It is misuse of that minute independence for the conditioned soul to think that he can also enjoy like the Supreme Lord, or to think, why shall I not be a free enjoyer like the Supreme Lord? This forgetfulness of his constitutional position is due to anger or envy. So, you know, we take the whole situation as ignorance, and there's that original envy of the Supreme Lord, tamisra. The living entity, being eternally a part and parcel servant of the Supreme Lord, can never by constitution be an equal enjoyer with the Lord. So when he forgets this, however, and tries to be one with him, his condition is called tamisra. So that's that envy. So, you know, interesting, even in the field of spiritual realization, this tamisra mentality of the living entity is hard to overcome. Yeah. So, you know, even those who try to get out of the material world, they're overcome by this tamisra. Under tamisra involves considering death to be the ultimate end. The atheists generally think that the body is the self, and that everything therefore ended with the end of the body. Thus they want to enjoy material life as far as possible during the existence of the body. So they want to enjoy material life as far as possible during the existence of the material body. So absorption in material pleasure, you know, that's how Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, describes it. So Prabhupada is giving even the root of why that absorption is there, is because they consider death to be the end. The theory is, as long as you live, you should live prosperously, never mind whether you commit all kinds of so-called sins. You must eat sumptuously, beg, borrow and steal, and if you think that by stealing and borrowing you are being entangled in sinful activities for which you'll have to pay, then just forget that misconception, because after death everything is finished. Right, so, you know, this is the atheism. So this under tamisra ignorance is due to tamas. The spirit, the condition of not knowing anything about the spirit soul is called tamas. So, you know, there is a basic on the material platform, one forgets one's spiritual condition, and that forgetfulness, not knowing anything about one's spiritual situation, is called tamas. Then one becomes absorbed in the body, which they think will come to an end. That's under Tamisra. The material world is also generally called tamas, because 99% of its living entities are ignorant of their identity as a soul. Everyone's thinking they're the body. So of course, you know, for such people, sex life is the background of material existence. So, you know, that when there's opportunity for sex life, they become attached to home, motherland, children, wealth, opulence. You know, these attachments increase. That's moha. So moha is increase of the bodily concept of life due to attachment. An increase in illusion. You know, defined very simply by Vishwanath Chakrabarti, the core is egoism. You know, identifying not only with the body, but with, you know, everything related to the body. Maha moha means to be mad after material enjoyment. Maha moha. Again, Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, has described that as attachment. Especially in this age of Kali, everyone is overwhelmed by the madness to accumulate paraphernalia. Maha, maha moha, big time madness. To accumulate paraphernalia for material enjoyment. So Prabhupada describes that these you know, definitions are given in the Vishnu Purana. You know, so there are slight variations on, you know, the technicalities of the Sanskrit meaning, but we can understand, you know, as Prabhupada nicely points out, that under Tamisra. Or a tamizram, you know, that's that envy can exist, you know, even before we enter the material world, tamizram, and certainly therefore it is there when we arrive in this material world, and the platform of material existence is tamas, because that is the platform of forgetfulness of the spiritual nature of the soul, and. On that bodily platform, one tries to enjoy the material body, absorbed in that under tamizram, and you know, by that one becomes identifies more and more with the body and the attachments. That's the moha, and of course there's maha moha, which is, you know, the, you know, mad, you know, just a very intense type of illusion. It's like we get in Kali Yuga. And, you know, you see that amongst the demoniac persons, of course. You know, the demoniac persons, their sense of attachment and you know, desire to enjoy becomes extremely intense, to the point where they're you know, prepared to commit any sort of abominable activity, even at their own, you know, peril at that. So these are manifested from Brahma's shadow. Yeah, Brahma's quite a fascinating personality in himself, in that in one sense he exists in three slightly different features. One is the four-headed Brahma. Literally as the embodiment of the universe, the living entities within it. And then of course there is the super soul. Brahma is quite a multifaceted person. Generally, there are considered three different aspects to Lord Brahma's existence. If you see Lord Brahma, fly down on a swan and, be offering prayers, talking to Krishna or something like that, then he can appear very, demigod-like. But he has quite a... an all-pervasive type of a feature as well. His shadow, as we will see, the various emanations that come from his body literally fill the universe. Now, in verse 19, out of disgust, Brahma threw off the body of ignorance, and taking this opportunity, Yakshas and Rakshasas sprang for possession of the body, which continued to exist in the form of night. Night is the source of hunger and thirst. I found an interesting quote, a letter Srila Prabhupada had written to Jadarani about this, answering some of her questions about this. Because you imagine her difficulty trying to paint all these things. Jadarani was one of the original painters. He says, Lord Brahma throwing off bodies is just like if there is some dirt on my body and I throw it off a little disgustedly. Just like if our body becomes dirty, many insects gather and we remove these insects with one hand and throw them away. That's an interesting analogy there.
It's not the same as Brahma casting off his body as in his mentality, right? That's comes later, is it?
There are different times that may have happened, such as when he chased Vak, his sister. His daughter, this appears to be another scenario.
Yeah. Mm.
Because the situation with his daughter,
yeah,
was evidently, possibly a previous Brahma or in a previous lifetime or something. The Acharyas don't consider it to be something related to this Brahma. After he'd been blessed by Krishna, it doesn't tally with Krishna saying that he would, protect him. Then the Yakshasas and the Rakshasas, they sprang for the possession of the body. So he had sort of a shadow body which he cast off. That shadow body became night. you know, so the universe is quite mystical in the sense that, you know, we know that night is what? When the sun goes down, you know, there is night. But, you know, all of these different aspects, night, day, they all have presiding deities. You know, they have presiding deities that look after them, and, you know, there are presiding deities that look after all the different sections of the night, and presiding deities that look after the sections of the day, and so forth like this. So, you know, so again, you know, when we think of nightfall, we just tend to think of the darkness. We don't, you know, accommodate the deities that may be presiding, and you know, the deities that may preside over the creatures, you know, of the night, and the creatures of the night themselves. So, you know, there's a far more reaching aspect to the Lord's creation usually than what we're aware of. So, and therefore, you know, such a nice analogy that Prabhupada gives in that description with Jadarani, that, you know, the body is covered by some dirt or something, and you know, you cast it off, and immediately a whole lot of living entities will inhabit, you know, what is being cast off. That, you know, anything you put down in this world for 2 seconds, you know, germs and bugs and, you know, something will come and they'll, you know, make use of that. There is nothing within this universe practically that a living entity won't immediately come and take shelter of for some purpose. That's the very nature. So, you know, it's the same principle here, but on a very large scale, universal scale. Now, there are certain demons that arise from Brahma at that particular time, and they accept that, you know, body that he has cast off as, you know, their place of habitation. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes an interesting point that Brahma gave up that body which produced hunger and thirst, that's that body of night, and he says that the Shruti says Sa Tamisra Bhava, that became Tamisra. When it says the Brahma body, it means that he gave up the mentality of that body. So sometimes Prabhupada, you know, mentions these things further in his purports. Since Brahma lived for 100 years, you know, Prabhupada's purport is quite interesting in that, you know, the previous purport is that he is saying that this Tamisra is the beginning. So, you know, and then at the same time, we're going to see that all five aspects of those ignorance appear from Brahma's body. So, although something may, you know, that Tamisra may be there in the spiritual world when the spirit soul first becomes envious of Krishna, it appears in a different way also, you know, in its material counterpart when it appears from the body of Brahma. And therefore, you know, both Prabhupada's and Vishwanath Chakravarti, the cause, you know, comments are reconciled in that way, that ultimately the beginning is tamas, or night, or you know, the ignorance. That is the basis of the others. So that's you understand that point? The Prabhupada, you know, he describes Tamisra as, you know, the beginning, as that envy of God. Of course, that happens in the spiritual world, that is. But then later, you know, when the living entity comes into the material world, you know, the five types of ignorance appear from the Brahma's body, including Tamisra, in a material counterpart. And the beginning, you know, that point is Tamas. And then later Tamisra will come. There's a few days' looks. What did you have for lunch? What was the hell for like? Plenty of ghee? Yeah. What's that?
Which lunch are you talking about?
Which lunch? How many lunches did you have? It's like you've had three.
I just had some.
Downstairs? Very good. Yeah. Yeah, what I was saying, yeah, go on.
I'm not clear on the difference between Tamisra and Tamas.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to go through them one by one.
Yeah.
And just to make sure we catch on, we're going to go through carefully Prabhupada's purports, and I'm looking at, you know, Vishwanath Chakravarti, the Course purports. Now, you know, Prabhupada made an interesting point. We're here talking about five aspects of ignorance which appear from Brahma's body. So that means they're coming from material creation. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions that this tamas, or, you know, ignorance of one's spiritual identity is the beginning, and then the other four will come from that. Now, of course, in the spiritual world, one would not be ignorant of one's spiritual identity. So therefore, the first, if we're talking about, you know, the very origin in the spiritual world, we might say tamisra, which is envy, might be the beginning of that. So if you're talking from the platform, of you're starting from the spiritual world, you might say tamisra is the beginning, as Prabhupada mentions in his purport. Mm-hmm. He'll be getting that from the various acharyas who are pointing out that. If you're talking from the platform of from Brahma in material creation, so the soul's already in material creation, he's already forgotten his spiritual identity, so tamas is the beginning. And then tamisra will come later, and then this tamisra is coming here. So
so physically in the spiritual world, it starts with tamisra. Yeah, there's tamas in the torture.
Yes, yeah, the so then, you know, it appears that the shadow body of Lord Brahma is the tamas aspect, right? And then what's that? Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah. So, you know, tamas arises first. Ignorance of one's spiritual identity. And then the rest of them, such as anger, which arises from tamas, you know, appears in the mind of Brahma, and from that the yakshasas and rakshasas appear. Anger and, you know, all the rest of them, they appear from the mind. you know, it's that mentality that Brahma rejects that becomes the night, and the yakshasas and rakshasas accept it. So in Brahma's mind there's a mentality of, you know, some of these different aspects of ignorance, and actually living entities manifest, take birth from that mental aspect of Brahma. They're the yakshasas and rakshasas, and they take shelter of the night, which is, you know, the mentality of tamas that Brahma casts off. Yeah, Brahma threw off the body of ignorance, that's the tamas. And taking this opportunity, the yakshasas and rakshasas sprang for possession of the body. In one sense, they're, you know, as described by the acharyas, those yakshasas and rakshasas take birth from the successive aspects of tamas, which, you know, manifest in the mind of Brahma. You know, as far as Lord Brahma casting off, you know, this body, we know that Brahma, of course, lives for 100 years, so it's not the end of Brahma and then there's a new Brahma. You know, the acharyas describe how even other devatas like Indra sometimes also are able to cast off certain bodies, in one sense, cast off a body, you know, in order to accept material enjoyment in different ways. So, you know, it's a feature that the demigods have to do that. Of course, you know, we see in this world also that, you know, snakes cast off a body and what have you, and then in a very subtle way we see that, you know, it's described in the scriptures that when one chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, then they become eligible to perform fire sacrifices, which means that, you know, now the Brahmanas say, in India, the caste Brahmanas, that means, oh yes, that means in the next birth they'll take birth and they'll be able to do it then. But the Shastras describe, no, in this birth, which means that they're casting off their a certain mentality, and therefore in casting off their mentality their body becomes like, you know, like the body of a Brahmana, because they've cast off the mentality of a Sudra, or that darkness or that ignorance like that. So it's a similar thing. Overpowered by hunger and thirst. So, you know, in our chart we've got the body of ignorance, or night. You know, and you can put tamas there. Where's that? Let's have a look at the Sanskrit. So, visaja admana kayam na vinandan tama mayam, made of ignorance. So it is talking about the tama aspect. Right, so the body he cast off, which became the night, refers to the tama. The yakshasas, overpowered by hunger and thirst, they ran to devour Brahma from all sides and cried, spare him not, eat him up. So, now, the representatives of the yakshas or rakshasas still exist in some countries of the world. It is understood that such uncivilized men take pleasure in killing their own grandfathers and holding a love feast by roasting the bodies. You'd want to be a grandfather in that sort of part of the world. But you know, that's that. I lived in New Zealand for 10 years as a devotee, and we once went to the hot mud pools. Anyone been to New Zealand? Yeah, yeah. Place in Hass, I think it's called, and you get in one mud pool and you can sort of sit, and it's quite hot, and then when you get used to that after 10 minutes you get into the next one, which is much hotter, and gradually you work up to the bulldog, you know, which if you first touch it, if you first just touch it with your finger, you can't even touch it, it's untouchable, you know. But as you go through the different mud pools, gradually you can actually sit in it. So, you know, we'd sit in there for a fair bit, basically cooking. So anyway, some big Maori men came and sat down, you know, on both sides of me. I think I was alone at this stage with a couple of big Maori fellas on either side. You know, the fellas, that's what they call them, Maori fellas, right? Well, choice brother, choice brother. So anyway, I said to them, what did you used to do, you know, back in the old days in these mud pools? And they go, oh, Pakeha and Puha. Oh, Pakeha and Puha, what's that? There's the white pig. White pig means human. That's the Pakeha. Pakeha, you know, in New Zealand they call white men Pakeha. And Pakeha actually means white meat. Yeah, it's like the white, you know, it's nice. And puha is like a type of this wild spinach that grows there. Pakeha. So, you know, I quickly got out and went and caught up with my godbrothers in another mud pool. So, you know, as Prabhupada says, these there are representatives of these personalities here and there, you know, in the world. You know, there are different, of course, no slight on the Maori people. There are different groups, you know, there's the Moriori and there's the Maori, and, you know, there are different actually tribes. Some of them were much more peaceful than others, and some of them were, you know, very, very violent, you know, cannibalistic and, you know, what have you. Yeah. Wasn't that long, you know, if you actually go back, I think even 100 years, you know, in New Zealand there were people, cannibals. And some parts of the world they still exist in.
Also in New Guinea.
New Guinea, of course, yeah. Yeah, that's famous for it, yeah. So, alright, now verse number, so yakshas and rakshasas. Brahma, the head of the demigods, full of anxiety, asked them, do not eat me, but protect me. You were born from me and have become my sons. Therefore you are yakshas and rakshasas. So, Prabhupada's purport, the demons were born from the body of Brahma, were called yakshas and rakshasas, because some of them cried that Brahma should be eaten, others cried that he should be not protected. The ones who said that he should be eaten were called yakshas, and the ones who said that he should not be protected became rakshasas, man-eaters. The two, yakshas and rakshasas, are the original creation by Brahma and are represented even until today, scattered all over the universe. They're man-eaters. You know, and therefore, you know, from the Bhagavatam, we can understand that there are, you know, there are tales of werewolves and, you know, vampires and, you know, things like this. Their origin stems from fact. You know, there is some basis of fact in, you know, that there are a class of persons who just absolutely, you know, just as, you know, we may, you know, if you miss out on breakfast, you know, and you'll be craving some, you know, nice sabji and curd sabji, and how you'll be, you know, you'll be thinking about it, and you know, and if you haven't eaten by dinner, you'll be going a little bit crazy. So, you know, these people, if they don't get there, if they don't eat people, you know, and in the, yeah, in the Krishna book it describes that, you know, there are witches and they particularly like to eat the, you know, the livers and that of little babies and things. So, you know, these things all have, you know, basis in fact. Yeah, they still... Hannibal, Silence of the Lambs. There are still people who do that. Yeah, that's a fact. There was, you know, one devotee, sannyasi, even in the 80s, was describing that in New York, in the underground, there was a class of people who they would go to, you know, underground restaurants to eat baby fetuses. Now these things are still existing, you know, today, even in the middle of, you know, civilized cities. Yeah, probably. Yeah, it's probably as, you know, close as they can get without getting thrown in jail. Mm. So just, you know, have a look over your shoulder next time you're walking down the street. All right. Now, verse number 22, he then created the chief demigods who were shining with the glory of goodness. So this answers your question. Yep. You still remember it with all that halva swirling around? Yep. He dropped before them the effulgent form of daytime, and the demigods sportingly took possession of it. So, you know, the summary being that yakshas and rakshasas are born with the quality of ignorance, demons are born with the quality of goodness. You know, which, and generally, you know, astrologically, for instance, certain planets like Mars and Saturn, they represent the night, they represent tamagun, and therefore, you know, their influence is usually stronger at night, and certain planets are, you know, stronger in the daytime. You know, when a person takes birth, if the planets which represent day, if the person was born in the day, they gain some numerical strength. And if the person was born at night, then some of the planets representing the lower modes gain strength like that. And that's how you give some numerical strength to the different planets to work out how they're going to affect people. So you see how this science, you know, just goes right through various Vedic sciences. Yeah, that's right. Everything is connected to, you know, everything has a particular signification, yes. So in essence, you know, there was a shadow, the tamas, the Brahma's body, and then there was a certain effulgence about Brahma's, or a shine about Brahma's body. That is, you know, what is referred to as becoming the day. So, you know, in the mentality of Brahma, here disguised by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, purity, the mentality of sattva, appeared in the mind of Brahma. From that, the devatas appeared. And, you know, that purity of mind became the day. And the devatas accepted that day, the day. So we see that, you know, from the impurity, the rakshasas and yakshas appeared and accepted the night, which is the darkness, or the tamas aspect. In verse 23 we see Lord Brahma, so that's the second thing that you have in the list, creations. It says boy of goodness. Does it say boy of yeah okay, it should be body of goodness, of course. Daytime taken body, yeah. On page 146 of your student handbook. Lord Brahma then gave birth to the demons from his buttocks, and they were very fond of sex. Because they were too lustful, they approached him for copulation. So this is very interesting. We've got to be careful what we say here. Is, you know, we do have, you know, our movement is open to everyone. It says sex life is the background of material existence, and you know the demons are especially fond of sex life. The more one is free from desires for sex, the more he is promoted to the level of the demigods, and the more one is inclined to enjoy sex life, the more he is degraded to the level of demoniac life. So you know, we've had tamas in Brahma's mind, from which the rakshasas and yakshasas appeared. We've had the sattva, from which the demigods appeared. And now we have the rajas within the mind of Brahma, from which the demons appear. So, you know, these rakshasas and yakshasas are more the mode of ignorance, and the demons are more passionate ignorance. Yeah? Yeah? Well, yeah, it describes it. It does come up in this chapter. We'll get to that. Yeah, we'll get. It appears so. It appears that they are male at this stage. It says they approached him for copulation. Sounds like a male term to me. What's that? Okay. Is it a medical? We need a medical dictionary. Mainly in the insect world. Yeah. So, does copulation we generally refer to males? Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, now the worshipful Brahma first laughed at their stupidity, but finding the shameless asuras close upon him, he grew indignant and ran in great haste out of fear. I think I would too. Sexually inclined demons have no respect even for their father, and the best policy for a saintly father like Brahma is to leave such demoniac sons. Yes. Now, in verse 25, he approached the personality of Godhead, who bestows all boons and who dispels the agony of his devotees and of those who take shelter of his lotus feet. He manifests his innumerable It'd be funny, dear Lord, you know, I mean, imagine you go before the Lord, you know, what's your problem, you know? He manifests his innumerable transcendental forms for the satisfaction of his devotees. Yeah. You want to change the batteries? Yeah. So there's a long purport there about how Krishna gives protection. We won't go into that. We'll stick on the creation side of things. Verse 26, Lord Brahma approaching the Lord addressed him thus, "My Lord, please protect me from these sinful demons who were created by me under your order. They are infuriated by an appetite for sex and have come to attack me." Now, this is a very interesting purport, and of course whoever does this chapter in their, you know, individual presentation will need to handle this very carefully, you know, because they are, you know, when you're doing presentations, when you get such strong statements in the chapter which evoke, you know, all sorts of different reactions for persons you can imagine who are reading it, you know, you'd almost lose marks for not explaining it, you know. So in essence, you know, you're presenting a chapter of the Bhagavatam in your presentation. If you didn't cover this somehow and in a nice way, you know, it'd be a great omission, because you can guarantee that anyone who does read it wants to know from you in your presentation what is your view on this. So you sort of got to cover these controversial sort of things like that, or, you know, anything. It appears that the homosexual appetite of males for each other is created in this episode of the creation of the demons. In other words, the homosexual appetite of a man for another man is demoniac, is not for any sane male in the ordinary course of life. So, you know, of course, in Krishna consciousness, you know, we accept persons from all walks of life to Krishna consciousness, but in the same way that, you know, when a person comes to Krishna consciousness, if they want to become a member of good standing, they would give up eating meat, you know, and things like that. So then you would expect also, according to this, that, you know, just because, you know, the sex appetite or the sex life is meant principally for bringing children into the world. Otherwise, you know, just for base sexual pleasure, you know, it really, you know, it's practically not possible to, let's say, dovetail that propensity in the same way you can't dovetail a propensity for killing, you know, cows in Krishna consciousness. You either stop, you know, you know, and even if someone says, well, you know, I run a butcher's shop and I'll donate some money, you know, we'll you know, use it to, you know, decorate, you know, the hall or something, you know. It's possible, but, you know, generally the devotees may not want to be associated, be sponsored by, you know, it's possible. We accept money from all sorts of persons, but you know, I know on the far there's a family who runs a, you know, a business where they do sell meat in their business, and they wanted, you know, the devotees sometimes do home programs and go to their homes, but they won't go to their home until they, you know, stop, you know, somehow selling meat and what have you. So, you know, there are certain, you know, they won't go and eat in their home. So it's a big impediment to devotional life. It's something that's not really able to dovetail. Any comments or questions? Or? What's that? Putana, yeah. Is she homosexual?
No,
I'm just trying to get the connection. No. Yes, the word demon can describe both male and female, yes. So, it definitely does. You know, strangely enough, in Vedic society, as I said, everyone is accommodated in Vedic society, but notwithstanding that, there is still some impediment on their spiritual life. So in Vedic society, many persons from the third sex, as we may call them, of which there are many varieties, you know, I won't get into too much, but, you know, there's males who like males. There's males who like males. There's females who like females. There are males who are homosexual but who also like females. There are eunuchs, you know, who've been castrated, who are basically attracted to females but, having been castrated, lose their sexual appetite and become a little bit effeminate. You know, so there's a variety of different aspects of homosexuality, but where they were, of course, still cultured persons who weren't overly attached to sex life. See, many homosexuals in Kali Yuga, you know, that their mind is, you know, just totally absorbed in the body and sex life. Now, that sort of homosexuality causes them and sometimes society a lot of trouble. This is where, you know, it's a quality that we would associate with a demoniac quality, just excessively attached to sex. But there are many homosexuals who, you know, are not particularly attached to sex, but have that sort of nature, homosexual nature, and they're very, you know, they're ordinary people in another sense. The ordinary people that you would invite to your home, you would invite to your, you know, to look after your children or to, you know, associate with it. No, it's a fact. You know, some of them, their sexual appetite is quite contained. So in Vedic culture, many homosexuals of different varieties, they're actually brought to different festivals. If the big festival on, they would invite them to give blessings and to, you know, entertain and to make everything lively, because that they have that sort of nature. It was considered auspicious, but not those who were excessively. And I think you'll see that in the Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto, you know, some of the different festivals that are there in the 10th canto, you'll see that they invited persons like that. So it's not, you know, we have to be a little careful of making blanket statements that cover every homosexual and categorise them all as demons, because it's not the case. But where there is excessive sex desire, certainly that's the aspect of homosexuality which is disturbing to society, which really blocks spiritual life, and which, you know, may prevent them from really being able to, you know, integrate, you know, in a civilized society or a Krishna conscious society. But otherwise, you know, there are many homosexuals whose sex propensity is, you know, much more control, you know, in which case we should be very careful not to just lump them in with everyone else. Yes, that's right. Yeah, in Krishna consciousness, therefore, if persons, you know, follow the four regular principles, whether they're homosexual or what have you, if they agree to follow the four regular principles, they can take initiation and be a member of ISKCON in good standing. You know, they follow the four regular principles like anyone else. Any other questions or comments? So, yes, because, you know, people can, this what we said before, that a person who chants the holy names of the Lord can become purified in this lifetime, where they are actually even able to perform fire jagas, you know, which is usually something that they would have to take many, many, many births, you know, to come to a Brahminical. Which means that they may actually be born with, you know, their parents at the time of conception conceived a child who had very, very strong influence of the modes of passion, demoniac, and ignorance, you know, like the Rakshasas, into their womb, and that person therefore has certain, you know, very bad tendencies, but that can be overcome by Krishna consciousness. So these things are coming from a previous life, and they can, it can drag right through life to a certain point until they associate with sadhus and they become Krishna conscious, and then literally there is a residual effect, you know, by their psychophysical makeup, but at the same time, by and large, they're on the same platform as any other devotee. Prabhupada tells the story of one thief who went on pilgrimage with the sadhus, and so all his life he had been a thief. So what happened is, when, you know, but he was really enjoying their association and feeling very purified and Krishna conscious. When they all went to sleep, he felt, I have to get up, and I have, you know, I can't stop stealing in the night. So he woke up at night. Anyway, when they all got up, they woke up and they said, oh, you know, my things are missing. And everyone, yes, my things are missing, you know, like this. And he said, oh, don't worry. You know, I was actually born in a family of thieves. I have that quality. What I did was, because I couldn't control myself, I simply moved your things from one place to another. So, you know, like that. In that way, I was sort of, you know. And actually, in the Krishna book, you know, one of the 64 arts that Krishna learnt is how to subdue desires. That sometimes persons have very strong desires, even sex desire, and there is an art how to subdue them. You know, so this is sort of an example that he just moved things. So he didn't steal it, but there is something within his nature that may linger, and yet really there was no offence, you know, like that.
So what do we make of the fact that as a bhakti who was, the bhakti was in the public part of the bhakti, he was very nice, he was great Maharaj, a big Maharaj, fell down, as we feel that in fact he's been falling down all the way, in fact he wasn't actually.
Yeah, look, it's, you know, when we come to Krishna consciousness, if in our previous lifetime we have, you know, cultivated pious activities and even devotional service, it makes it, when one takes up Krishna consciousness, it makes it a lot easier for that person, because they're not having to recondition themselves on such a radical platform. You know, over many lifetimes they've come to a nice standard, so in Krishna consciousness, you know, the steps that they're taking are not much different to what they may have been doing for many lifetimes. Some come to Krishna consciousness, and they're coming from, you know, previous lifetimes. They may have had association or something very, very wonderful for some period of time which gave them immense blessing, but their general habits may have been very much conditioned by the lower modes of nature, and therefore when they come to Krishna consciousness, it's a lot harder for them to literally, you know, it's possible they stick at it, but there's a lot more work for them, you know, to change their proclivities. And if they're not alert, it can, you know, once again, you know, manifest very easily. Yes, that it's a good lesson. You know, it's a lesson that we learn, you know, in ISKCON, that you know, we should, in one sense, be aware of our past. Therefore, you know, I get this a lot because I'm an astrologer. People say, oh, astrology is for fools and rascals. You know, we're all devotees, we're all chanting Hare Krishna, we don't have any karma. You know, and I think, you know, you have very little understanding of Krishna consciousness, and you don't know the history of, you know, Krishna consciousness, because, you know, that, you know, proclivity, with, you know, there are four stages of sin, of which the first one is the proclivity. What do they call it? Kuta, bija? Kuta and bija. We learned this in... Yeah, that from the proclivity, which is almost a second nature, as a result of all the things we've done in a previous life, it creates such an impression we have a certain way of doing things. You know, and from that proclivity comes our desires. That's the next stage. That's the seedling. So the seed is a proclivity, the seedling is the desire, of the seedling of karma. Then we act upon it, that's actually the reaction manifesting, and then that manifests the karmic reaction, and then the result of all of that is it stores a future reaction that's not manifesting now, it will come. And it comes in the form of our proclivity in our next lifetime. So, you know, it is, I think it's at the stage of ruchi or a shakti that, you know, a devotee is considered to be, there is an absolute destruction of one's karma right down to the root. Then, on the platform of a shakti, bhava, is when any aparadhas that we performed in this life or in previous lives to Vaishnavas or the Lord or the deity, they're not removed until, you know, bhava stage. And they also check us from actually rising to a higher level. And it's only on the stage of prema that the aparadhas are also absolutely removed, 100%. So actually, you know, when we say, oh, our karma's all gone, you know, by and large, but actually at different stages, technically, there's an absolute platform of, you know, karma's completely gone. Karma's absolutely gone. There are two different stages. Complete, basically devotee is not, doesn't have karma, but that proclivity may still be there, and if there are aparadhas, offences, it checks them from getting a taste from devotional service, and therefore once again they get a taste from their original proclivities and it again comes out. So this is all very, you know. So therefore, you know, devotees just have to be very careful to, you know, run around saying, yes, I chant Hare Krishna, I'm a liberated soul, like this. Prabhupada describes, you know, there's official liberation. You know, as soon as you take to Krishna consciousness, you're liberated. That's official liberation. As soon as you start chanting Hare, you're officially liberated. Then that official liberation, you know, actually manifests in different degrees to, you know, complete liberation.
Yeah.
Because Prabhupada actually, in order to establish the movement, he very quickly placed people into positions of sannyas, you know, initiation, Brahman, GBC, you know, temple president. Someone had been in the movement for, you know, a month. You know, Prabhupada wants to open a temple. You know, there's two people in this temple, you know, one of them he's sending away, or you've been here an extra month, you know. It's like that, you know. So, these persons took, you know, a massive responsibility beyond their ability. And as long as they kept the shelter of Prabhupada, they would be okay. But it's like asking anyone in this room here, you know, you go to China, you know, you take this whole, you know, section and you establish Krishna consciousness. For anyone here in this room, you know, we wouldn't even dream of it, but they did, you know. Or, you know, we just say, well, you know, you take sannyas tomorrow and you know, go out preaching. And you know, these people took a massive big risk, and you know, in one sense, some of them got through and some of them didn't, but you know, that's how a movement started. So Krishna is going to adjust that. Yes, you know, some things were very, very terrible, so they will suffer, and at the same time they took massive risks, so that he will also accommodate for that. Yeah, I think it's Ruchi.
Six stages.
Yeah, nine, I think. Eight and nine.
Yeah, out of nine.
Yes, it's Ruchi. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, Bhajani Kriya, Anatha Nivritti, Nishta, Ruchi. Alright, so, you know, it's interesting to understand these things, because it is in relationship to homosexuality, which is a big subject, because, you know, this is a very strong statement, and we certainly don't want our bhakti by bhavis or bhavis, you know, running around, you know, or you're a demon, you know, or something like that. You know, these things have to be understood very, very carefully. And they, as I say, there are some examples where, you know, from, you know, within the society, you know, there are different levels, different types of association with persons of a homosexual background, and we have to be able to apply, and this is, you know, why we do bhakti by bhava courses, so that we have evaluation skills, academic and moral integrity. There is this one, you know, statement here, but we're going to see several statements. You put them all together, and of course that's why you have a teacher, because you hope that your teacher has seen, you know, many of the other statements, so that, you know, if you're not aware of them, at least before any serious mistakes are made, you know, you can be just have a very broad-minded attitude of some very powerful statements that are there. Karma is gone from about Ruchi to Shakti. That's gone. And at around that, just after karma goes, the results of, actually the first one to go is the reactions to offences to worshipping the Lord. Then karma, then aparad. Aparad is the last to go. Anyway, we'll come back to that. You know, I think in the teachings of Lord Kapila, we actually discuss that, how the different modes of material nature affect devotional service. So we'll take up that, you know, quite in depth, that subject there, the different levels. So we'll leave it for now. We'll just get back to creation. But you know, here's a very important purport. It's good to have some broad understanding of it like that. Yeah. Any other quick comments or questions on that before we just move on? Okay. Now, verse number 27. My Lord, you are the only one capable of ending the affliction of the distressed and inflicting agony on those who never resort to your feet. So he's praying to the Lord. So, you know, it's interesting here. You are the only one capable of ending the affliction of the distressed and inflicting agony on those who never resort to your feet. You know, Prabhupada says, the words klesha das tisham and asana padam tava indicate that the Lord has two concerns. The first is to give protection to persons who take shelter of his lotus feet, and the second is to give trouble to those who are always demoniac and who are inimical toward the Lord. So, you know, klesha. You know, klesha, that is distress, yeah. Mm. There are different types of kleshas. And those kleshas are distress from karma. That means that the Lord removes karma. But that removal of karma, which means liberation, as we said, from official liberation to the various degrees of liberation till one is completely liberated. So it's not wrong to say that, you know, the devotees, they're all liberated persons. It's not wrong to say that. But, you know, in a more, you know, in-depth look at it, we see that some are officially liberated, which means that they're, you know, the Lord is protecting them from their karma. But they may have a lot of, you know, seeds of, you know, karma there. And others, you know, even the proclivity to sin is just removed. Verse number 28. Yeah. Like a what?
Like a blazing fire.
Blazing fire, yes.
And it,
yes.
It burns up even the snakes.
Yes. Of desire, yes. No, 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 it takes away everything. You know, the heart is to remove the seeds.
But the paradigm is already fructified, they say now that will be there. It's already fructified. The paradigm can, it has to come, that can go, but the paradigm is already fructified that you have to bear with. That's what the devotee is facing. But the rest of all are burnt off.
Is that, you say, they say, who says? Okay. Where's our Bhakti Shastriites? What do you say about Aparabdha? Is that the one, the Parabdha, the manifest karma, that's removed as well?
Everything.
Everything, yeah. Removed, but the last thing though is Prarabdha, because
the body is Prarabdha.
Yeah, the body,
yeah.
But at the same time, you know.
Aparabdha has to go.
Yeah. So in that sense, yeah. But you know, the material body, but if a devotee's body is completely spiritualized, completely engaged in the service of the Lord, then we don't consider that that is parabdha. And even if they're suffering, you know, if they're on the spiritual platform, it's not a result of karma. It's a result of you know the dealings with Krishna, you know.
This is for devotees, or just for the ones who are
there? Well, devotees who are proper devotees, you know, the really, really devotees. You know, the really devotees, but. No, you know, devotees who are basically sincerely trying to follow, you know, that's what I mean. I'm not talking about, you know, ultimate adhikaris or what have, you know, just from Madhyama adhikaris, to Kanishthas who are very, very sincere, very determined, from the very beginning. They're the ones that they get the maximum effect of, they're taking the medicine properly. So, for instance, if you're at the very beginning of an illness or at the very end, there's two types of persons that can be in the beginning of an illness. One will take the medicine as prescribed and the diet. Another one at the beginning doesn't take the medicine properly or the diet. The one from the very beginning will get the maximum effect of cure and reduction of suffering, and the other one will get the least. So these things apply from the very beginning of devotional service to everyone, according to how they fully apply what they should be doing on their level. Yes, from the very beginning of devotional service, if Krishna detects that this person has actually sincerely surrendered unto me, then actually from the very beginning they're under the direct supervision of Krishna. Whatever karma they have, Krishna is almost personally feeding it out with a little teaspoon. So it's not exactly karma even from the very beginning, because it's very similar to what you would have got according to your karma, but because Krishna is personally directing it, it's not exactly karma. So verse 28, the Lord who can distinctly see the minds of others, perceive Brahma's distress, and said to him, "Cast off this impure body of yours." Thus commanded by the Lord, Brahma cast off his body. So, now in this purport, we see that, according to Sridhar Swami, Brahma's constant dropping of his body does not refer to his actually giving up his body. He suggests that Brahma gave up a particular mentality. Mind is a subtle body of the living. So it is a body, the mind. It's a body as well. It's a subtle body. We may be absorbed in some thought which is sinful, but if we give up the sinful thought, it may be said that we give up the body. So, that would answer, the Purva Svadvaya question. What is meant by Brahma's giving up his present body? That's question 9. So it's interesting how Krishna did protect, or the Lord did protect Brahma in a very practical way. And of course, part of being protected by Krishna is that, he actually gives protection and we take the remedy. And the same as you go to a doctor, give me protection from the illness. He says, all right, I'll give you this medicine and, this diet. That's the protection, and you don't take it. The person doesn't take it, comes back, said, "Doctor, you said you'd protect me, I'm still sick." Now, the body given up by Brahma took the form of the evening twilight and the day and night meet, a time which kindles passion. The Asuras, who are passionate by nature, dominated as they are by the element of Rajas, took it for a damsel whose lotus feet resounded with the tinkling of anklets, whose eyes were wide with intoxication and whose hips were covered by fine cloth over which shone a girdle. So, nice purport there that morning period is for spiritual cultivation. The beginning of evening is the period for passion. Therefore they like that approach of evening. They like to get off work at 5 and be home by the, by the twilight. The demons took the approach of the evening twilight to be a beautiful woman. Yes.
So the body that the Lord is wearing is the Raja.
Throwing off a subtle body. I can't see that as mentioning, passion or ignorance, but as an educated guess, it appears to be in between the two, between night and day. Maybe a mixture of passion and ignorance, sort of thing. Must be a mixture of ignorance because there's a darkness coming. The light is going, so it must be going from sattva to rajas, like that. So I'd imagine it'd be a mixture of tamas and rajas. Adorned by the dark with dark tresses, she hid herself as it were out of shyness. Upon seeing that girl, the Asuras were infatuated with an appetite for sex. Analyze the difference between a demon and a devotee. The difference between demons and demigods is that a beautiful woman very easily attracts the minds of demons, but she cannot attract the mind of a godly person. And again, we'll see in verse 34 there's something. Just as a child is attracted by a beautiful doll, similarly a demon who is less intelligent and full of ignorance is attracted by material beauty and an appetite for sex. The godly person knows that this nicely dressed and ornamented attraction of high breasts, high hips, beautiful nose and fair complexion is maya. All the beauty a woman can display is only a combination of flesh and blood. The real beauty is Krishna and Radha. One who is attracted of the beauty of Radha and Krishna cannot be attracted by the false beauty of this material world. That's the difference.
So. Yeah, even such statements can be taken, can be like the audience, ignorant audience can involve, particularly when it's like on beauty of woman, there's a combination of flesh and blood. So
You said.
Should we be careful in such cases?
Well, yes, you wouldn't go up to, a woman comes up and flutters her eyelashes at you, and you say, you're just a bag of,
blood
and pus and bones.
Yes.
And she spent the last hour trying to do herself up to attract your attention. She might go and jump off, point suicide or something. Jump off the cliff.
Isn't that true for everybody's body? That they're made up of
new? No, not the men, just the women.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't see here mentioned the men. No. Is it? Hey? Yes, that's right. That's right. That's the time. Yeah. That's right. You know. Therefore, if you go up, you know, Chapel Street or you know what have you at that particular time, mm-hmm. Toorak Road, all the restaurants. Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else want to throw a few street names in? Is it, hey? Put in the little black book. Yeah, you go. It's well here. It's saying that. Let me just read from. They imagine the twilight to be a woman. Vishwanath Chakravarti, the course commentary is this, that verse 37 explains that this woman was imaginary. So he jumps ahead a little bit to tell us. He's saying, verse 37 explains that this woman is imaginary. They took the twilight to be a woman. All right? So it's not necessarily, this is not saying that he created women at this stage. He's saying, huh? Yeah. Yes. Yes, it's a material form which they take to be a woman. That means it's not. I'll read the commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti the Core. You see, they imagine the sounds of birds returning to their nests in the twilight to be the sound of the anchor bells. So it's not a woman's anchor bells, it's actually the birds. They imagine the clouds with specific shapes to be the woman's feet, eyes, hips and breasts. The word payodara, which means clouds, is also another word for breast. The pink colour of the sunset was a pink dress. Because of rubbing together, the breasts become raised without space between them. The disappearance of the clouds was her act of hiding in shyness. So, you know, the clouds appear to be like the breasts, and then when they dissipate, they think that she's very shy, she's hiding her breasts. Her smile and glance were like a small amount of the sun's rays. Her black hair extending from her head to her feet was a towering black cloud. They're imagining something. Yes. Yeah, well, you know, a devotee sees Krishna everywhere, and a lusty man sees beautiful women everywhere.
I think they mean that such demons, they just see women everywhere, particularly.
Everything, yeah. Yes, the twilight is particularly good for imagining, because of the particular modes that predominate. You know, they've been working hard all the day, you know. I'm the enjoyer. Why am I working so hard? I should be enjoying, and, you know. Sooner to be night, to be tired, to be, you know. And, you know, in the particular moonlight and everything looks so much more wonderful. They're a little bit You know, at that time of the day, a person, you know, after working hard, they may not be thinking as clearly as what they would be during the Brahma Muhurta. So, you know, their intelligence becomes a bit dazed. So, you know, it's sort of, it's like that. So we go to verse 33, indulging in various speculations about the evening twilight, which appeared to them endowed with the form of a young woman, the wicked minded Shuras treated her with respect and fondly spoke to her as follows: "Who are you, O pretty girl? Whose wife or daughter are you, and what can be the object of your appearing before us? Why do you tantalize us, unfortunate as we are, with the priceless commodity of your beauty?" So, you know, it's interesting, the demoniac mentality that, you know, if there is something of value or of beauty, they assume it is meant for their enjoyment. Prabhupada mentions the demoniac can pay any price for the skin beauty of this material world. Now, Marilyn Monroe quoted that she said, "Hollywood is such a place that they would pay $1,000 for a kiss and, you know, a nickel for your soul." From Marilyn Monroe. And Prabhupada expresses that here, and, you know, the demoniac can pay any price for the skin beauty of this material world. They work hard. They work hard all day and night, but the purpose of their hard work is to enjoy sex life. That's just what I was saying. So, you know, if they've been working hard for sex life, and, you know, the day is running out, and they haven't, you know, enjoyed sex life, and of course the evening time is particularly suitable to it, they will be getting agitated. So verse 35, "Whosoever you may be, a beautiful girl, we are fortunate in being able to see you. While playing with a ball, you have agitated the minds of the onlookers." So just, you know, how interesting it is that, you know, just from the very beginning of creation, you know, the same principles have been there, the universal principles, as we see here. Prabhupada says, you know, the question, we ask the question, what is the purpose of sporting events with the opposite sex? Demons arrange many kinds of performances to see the glaring beauty of a beautiful woman. Here it is stated that they saw the girl playing with a ball. Sometimes the demoniac arranged for so-called sports like tennis with the opposite sex. The purpose of such sporting is to see the bodily construction of the beautiful girl and enjoy a subtle sex mentality. You know, and of course, you know, when someone is sort of in a very playful mood, you know, it's you know, they may be feeling a little bit frivolous or, in one sense, you know, not caring whether they attract or in one sense even purposely trying to attract the attention of others, you know. So the playing with the ball has different connotations, implications and insinuations. Verse 36, "O beautiful woman, when you strike the bouncing ball against the ground with your hard, your hand again and again, your lotus feet do not stay in one place. Oppressed by the weight of your full-grown breast, your waist becomes fatigued and your clear vision grows dull, as it were. Pray braid your comely hair." So as Prabhupada says, that moths at night surround a fire and are killed, so the demons become victims of the movements of the ball-like breasts of a beautiful woman. The scattered hair of a beautiful woman also afflicts the heart of a lusty demon. I've heard someone ask Prabhupada the question, you know, what does a woman's breast indicate? He said lust and envy. What's that?
About feeding
babies. That's right. Yeah, well, you know, lusty men don't think of that. They're thinking in terms of their, you know, as here, there's not much mention of feeding babies. You know, the demons, you know, the lusty men don't think in terms like that. What's that? They're just thinking in terms of sex life. You know, that's it. You know, they don't think in any other terms except sex life. You know, therefore, sometimes it's said that, you know, sometimes men do things foolish and people say, stop thinking with your penis. You know, that's what people say to them, you know. Because some men are like that, they're, you know, lusty men. They're literally, you know, their whole vision is just, you know, centered around their sex desire. They don't see beyond that. You know. I mean, that's right. Our Krishna conscious view is that sex life is meant for bringing children, which then the women will, you know, feed the children. Like, you know, that's the Krishna conscious view, or the Vedic, you know, conception. And therefore, you know, the Vedic conception is, you know, men are supposed to look at all men as mother. You know, and you look at men as mother, you think, you know, that they will, you know, one day, someone said to me the other day that, you know, because some women in ISKCON get very upset if you say Mataji, you know. They're like, yeah, they do, you know. Because in the past, what's that? Yeah, because some men use it, have used it in a, as if they're, you know, are the Matajis, or, you know, like, so, you know, because they've used it in a condescending way, it's derived a condescending connotation that shouldn't be there, because some men in ISKCON have used it. Therefore, sometimes you say, you know, you're doing the slokas, and you say, you know, the men do it, and you say Matajis or mothers, and it's like some of them are like, you know. But, you know, they do. But and then someone said to me the other day, well, you know, they're not all mothers, are they? Because there's little kids there, and, you know, but the little kids don't read the slokas. Usually, you know, when you say mothers or, you know, ladies, it's like that. The kids know. Well, you're talking to the adults. You know, the kids just keep drawing and playing. You know, but even young girls, you know, they're future mothers. You know, and the motherly instincts are there. I've noticed, you know, because having five daughters, that from the very, you know, beginning, they start manifesting a motherly instinct. From the time they start can play, they start wanting to be little mothers. And boys, you know, they don't. They manifest, you know, they like to break things, and, you know. push the girls over. But you know, that therefore, you know, that motherly instinct is practically there, and you can take a 2-year-old girl, and if a little baby comes in, she'll want to grab her, cut her, and be the mother, you know, like that. It's just, you know, the boys are there, baby, yeah, you know. I get the bottle and throw it in the bin. That's what I used to do to my sister. So, you know, mothers, we call them mothers. So that's the Krishna conscious view, but of course here we're seeing how the demoniac, you know, view everything in a different way. Like, you know, moths at night. So So we're up to four, the impure body mistaken for a beautiful damsel. Verse 37, the Asuras clouded in their understanding took the evening twilight to be a beautiful woman showing herself in an alluring form, and they seized her. So you know, Vishwanath Chakravarti, the course says they imagine the ball of the setting sun to be the red ball. So they imagine this woman actually to be a lusty woman trying to purposely agitate them in actuality. With a laugh full of deep significance, the worshipful Brahma then evolved by his own loveliness, which seemed to enjoy itself by itself, the host of Gandharvas and Apsaras. So the musicians in the upper planetary systems are called Gandharvas. The dancing girls are called Apsaras. Music and dancing employed in sense gratification are to be accepted as demoniac, but the same music and dancing when employed in glorifying the Supreme Lord as Kirtan are transcendental, and they bring about a life completely fit for spiritual enjoyment. The Gandharvas and Apsaras, well, they're, you know, the residents of the upper heavenly planets. They're very civilized persons. And they associate, you know, with very elevated demigods, sages, and most of the subject matter of their, fine arts are, you know, the pastimes of the Supreme Lord. So, at the same time, there's obviously some degree of attraction to enjoying the beautiful aspects of life and the comfortable and, you know, very pleasing sensual activities. So that aspect of them is there as well. Just as in, you know, if we take Vedic society as a whole, anyone existing, at the time of Maharaj Yudhisthira is existing in the most civilized this world has known for, you know, thousands and thousands of years. So they're all part of that great civilization. Yet, you know, the musicians and the what have you, you know, who would often perhaps, you know, sing of the glories of Yudhisthira and the Pandavas and their great exploits, would still have some, you know, propensity to enjoy, you know, sensually to some degree or another. So it's sort of like that, you know, they're within a very advanced civilization, so and they get the advantages of that, even though they may not be as elevated as everyone else in that civilization. So they're among the demigods, but they may not necessarily be as elevated as all the other demigods, but they're certainly above the humans.
The jiva should have, they said, one is they're doing it for the Lord's pleasure. But then if they're doing
things are not special, they are not becoming devotees because they are still in the material world.
Mm.
And they are singing and dancing. So you said a mixture of lost special and they want to enjoy the music and dance, and such people become Rathyatra.
Well, it's like when we have Rathyatra. You know, we have Rathyatra and we say to everyone, just they all come off the streets and we all act in unison to pull the cart. Now, you know, there can be a vast difference in the consciousness between all those different people that are hanging on to that rope of Lord Jagannath's cart. From Prabhupada, you know, all the way down to, you know, someone of very bad character. And yet, they're all acting in unison. So it's like that, you know, in the heavenly planets, or even in a society like, you know, Maharaj Yudhisthira's, you know, everything is organized so nicely because it's far more civilized in, you know, its organization and what have you, and those who are organizing it are very elevated in their consciousness. Anyone who takes part of that will benefit, even though they may not necessarily be on the same level, you know. And we, you know, people come to a kirtan. We have a kirtan in the temple room. People come from all walks of life. They all enjoy the benefit, even though the person leading the kirtan and the person who's, you know, managing the Sunday feast, they may be in very elevated consciousness. The people come from all walks of life and they all enjoy that kirtan nonetheless, let alone, but, you know, it's not that everyone walks out of that kirtan is necessarily a devotee. So it's like that, you know, similar.
So
they're taking part in devotional activities. Because of their piety, they get to enjoy existence in the heavenly planets. And so they're pious, they're good-hearted, and at the same time there's some desire to enjoy the sensual or the good things at life that, you know, nice for the senses. And, you know, they take birth in the heavenly planets where there is opportunity for such pious persons to actually come to a level of devotional service. They can actually use up their piety and not take that devotional aspect and actually just come back down and take a lower birth.
So that means people who have got an artistic mentality
and
who are very keen in that artistic, that they have a passion. You know, you have people who are so passionate about music, so passionate about dance, and they are singing many of the Bhajanati songs are always for the Lord. But they don't understand the meaning of it, but they're doing it.
Mm. No, not you don't become a Gandhara and an Apsara just by dint of your love of music or dance. You become, you know, you get elevated to the upper planetary systems by pious activities.
So they may be doing the rituals. I
mean,
not necessarily proper devotion service. But many of them,
if they're doing that, those, yeah.
Yes. They are singing all devotional songs actually.
Mm.
They're all devotional, the songs of the dance is really from devotional.
Mm.
So but they are not really able to apply that because they don't have a full understanding.
No.
So that way, and maybe they're good, they go to the temple, they, all those, you know, the ritualistic, but not any for full of ignorance.
Mm.
But they're doing all the rituals.
Yes. Well, you know, if they've got some serious sinful activities going on, such as, you know, meat eating or, you know,
many of them are from the
Brahma. Yeah. Well, a lot of Brahma, I know a lot of Brahma.
Meat eating or anything of that sort.
Oh, yeah.
Many of them.
Yeah, many, that's good.
So that would lead them to become upset. And
Not necessarily. They can take birth again, and just become more, in the human species and become opportunity to be more famous within human society for dancing and what have you. It takes a lot of piety to get to heaven. The very pious. There's a lot of piety to get to heaven. They're the most pious.
They have to serve the demigods, they have to. Meneka, she had to come down to the earth and she had to be there. So they have to do all that.
Mm.
They have to follow the orders of Indra and they have to. Usually, sometimes the ministers are used as prostitutes.
Well,
no, they're literally used as prostitutes.
Yes, but. Yeah, prostitutes in the heavenly planets is a whole different ball game to prostitutes here. Prabhupada said, women who part their hair on the side of prostitutes, It's like there are different statements, but they don't have things like abortion and contraception and so many things. From my understanding, many parts of the heavenly planets they have the child at the almost at the end when they're about to something like that. They're about to leave. Sex life, what is sinful here is not necessarily sinful in the heavenly planets. In other words, we may use the term prostitute, which means that they may enjoy sex with varieties of different men, which can be a very sinful activity here, but not necessarily in the heavenly planets. To some degree, they're called Sakama devotees, or devotees who have, some material desire. Although, by and large, their propensity to lord it over the material nature is quite subdued. It has to be. That's one of the qualifications to go to the heavenly planets. If you have a strong desire to lord it over the material nature, that's a big disqualification for going to the heavenly planets. But there's, a relationship with the Supreme Lord of respect, although they may not have love for God, but they may respect and serve God, that's the proper thing to do, that's the pious thing to do. That's different to what we're cultivating, love for God, that's a different thing. Here, the main thing to understand, of course, is that from this aspect of Brahma's mind, which is described as an impure body of twilight, was given up, become the body of loveliness, and the Gandharvas and Apsaras appeared. Verse number. Yes. Yes. There are some very famous Gandharvas and Apsaras. When Brahma remembered beauty, this is from Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core. When he remembered beauty, the Gandharvas appeared and the beauty became moonlight. So in Brahma's consciousness is his concept of beauty, and as Prabhupada described, worshipful Brahma then evolved by his own loveliness the host of Gandharvas and Apsaras. So, you know, we're talking about that contemplation of beauty and appreciation of beauty within Brahma's, you know, mind, and the host of Gandharvas and Apsaras have, you know, appeared, and that sense of beauty is that, you know, twilight light or the moonlight like that. So, you know, Gandharvas and Apsaras, in essence, we can understand, represent those who are beautiful by nature and who enjoy beauty at that. And because they're very pious, they're existing in the upper platforms of the universe. Now, it's also interesting, you know, that when do most musicians play? You know, a lot of it's around that time, isn't it? You know, after work, it's like before it's too late. A lot of that, you know, early evening time is good. Although, you know, I guess the more demoniac it becomes, it gets into the dead of night, the late, very late hours. After that, Brahma gave up that shining and beloved form of moonlight. Vishvavasu and other Gandharvas gladly took possession of it. So, the glorious Brahma next evolved from his sloth, the ghosts and fiends, but he closed his eyes when he saw them stand naked with their hair scattered. So ghosts and mischievous hobgoblins are also the creation of Brahma. They're not false. All of them are meant for putting the conditioned souls into various miseries. They are understood to be the creation of Brahma under the direction of the Supreme Lord. So, you know, slothful or sort of laziness, really, isn't it? The Buddhas and Pisachas. Buddhas and Pisachas. Ghosts and hobgoblins. Pisachas, yeah. Exorcism. What do you say? Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are people in ISKCON to do it. I've done a few. Yeah. I have, yeah. I have, yeah.
So is it a sacrifice?
Well, there are various ways of doing it. I mean, you know, I've heard one ancient remedy where they just beat the person with a stick until the ghost leaves. It's a fact. But I wouldn't recommend that.
Is there such a thing that there's a process to do this?
Yes. The easiest way is actually, you know, Ramanujacara. Actually, Prabhupada himself, when he was, he had nowhere really to stay, someone said he could stay in this big old haunted house. And they, you know, it's well known that there were ghosts in there. Prabhupada didn't mind. He said yes, you know, and he went there and he was able to, you know, do some work in his Bhagavatam. The ghost actually appeared to him and tried to, you know, scare him away out of the house, but it didn't disturb him. Did he end up? I don't know whether they end up leaving or what have you, but they certainly stopped coming to him because, you know, he just went on, you know, with the Bhagavatam. Ramanujacharya was asked to exorcise the daughter of the king, and there was also another ghost that lived in a tree, which I think Ramanujacharya. Many of our acharyas are well known for exercising very, very powerful ghosts that have been there for a long time and terrorized the people, you know, that no one could get rid of. And they did it by reciting the Bhagavad Gita. Yes. Yes, that's what they like to do. Yeah. Because
I was just wondering if it's officially okay for people to practice.
Well, when a devotee does it, basically what a devotee does is I'll just recite Bhagavad Gita, chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, purify the environment for that person, you know, make sure that it's completely suci, sprinkle some sacred water, light heaps and heaps of incense which has been offered to the Lord, have kirtan. That's usually all it takes. You know, it's not like the movies where they the ghosts are living people, yeah. Well, why would you take them out of a dead body? They're not disturbing anybody. Yeah, leave them there. If you whistle in the evening, you don't whistle in the evening because it puts holes in the air and it attracts ghosts. You know, or if you cut your nails and leave the clippings around, that will attract ghosts and thieves. Yeah. You know, so people, you know, when you clip your nails and what have you, you're supposed to, you know, dispose of them. I quite often go to people's homes and it's not uncommon, you know, people just, they'll sit and watch TV, clipping their nails and their, you know, the tail, there's like clippings going everywhere, you know, into the spaghetti and this, that, and that. You know, you see clippings all over the carpets and stuff. Very common, but it attracts ghosts and thieves, Buddhas and disruptors. What they do is they disturb the consciousness. So usually people who take a lot of intoxication, they weaken the chakra, the energy levels. You know, that we have a certain immunity to, ghosts and what have you entering in the body. But when people take intoxication, they destroy that strength of the body. It makes them weak and it allows them to come in. When there's severe stress over a long period of time, it weakens the, energy centers and what have you. Anything which can weaken the body, sometimes even a very severe knock on the head, can then weaken the body and the mind. Once the body and the mind are weak, because in Kali Yuga, the ghosts are everywhere, and they will take advantage and enter. And then what happens is that the person will generally act in a compulsive way. They have very, even if it's hurting them, they cannot stop to do what they're doing. And, generally the ghosts, because they're attracted to the lower modes of nature, they, influence the person they inhabit to be dirty in their lifestyle, because that's then that's very that creates a strong and attractive place for them to be, and it keeps those people in a weakened state. And too much sex life that actually weakens the mind and the body and allows for it goes to enter. Yeah, there's a few ghostly characters. I see them. Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. You can recognise them. Yeah. They have a certain way of walking as well. Yeah. Yeah, there's a little bit of a glazed look in the eyes, and you know, the hands that are hang low, you know, they don't really swing, you know. Is that, eh? We do the ghost here. Yeah, no, they. Is that a. You know, to one degree or another, you know, if they're really, but you see them all the time.
Do you think their behaviour would depend on how demonic the ghost is occupied?
Yes. Oh, yeah. The
more demonic they might act more.
Well, some, you know, if it's actually, these are karmic things, that if a person is particularly sinful in their last life, they can have the karma to be, possessed by a ghost, which causes them, as Prabhupada says in the purport, it actually causes them immense misery in their life. And sometimes that ghostly person can actually be someone that they have, you know, caused immense trouble to, and that person comes back to them in the form of the ghost, which destroys their life. So these are actually karmic. Severe karmic deaths that to be, you know, and you can look in someone's chart astrologically and see that they're, you know, likely to be haunted, you know, possessed by and harassed by ghosts of past relatives.
So another question comes up. So these people, they ask if they come in contact to say Avatam or
Sankhya
Sankhya, will the effect not work on them?
No, it works, but. From experience, of different devotees, and even myself, I was actually, I had a lot of experience with, because I used to astral travel and all sorts of things before I become a devotee, and, you know, it's a very dangerous thing to do. I have spoken to certain devotees who have experience where they're constantly, you know, harassed, there is sometimes they think that there's something wrong with me, you know, because it doesn't go away. And they really just have to stick at it, you know. They just have to keep chanting, keep themselves purified, be aware of the fact that somewhere in their previous, you know, somewhere in this life, they've become weakened and somehow disturbed. You know, it can be from childhood, you know. They get some person from a previous life who follows them right through life until they're able to. But if they keep chanting, keep taking prasad and what have you, it can take a couple of years sometimes. But, you know, quite often, if it's just, you know, if someone's just recently picked up a travelling companion, you know, that they don't want, then, you know, pretty much you come to the temple, you chant Hare Krishna, they'll go away. When there's something from a previous life that, you know, there's some, you know, strong karma, or we've caused trouble to that person, they've come back in the form of a ghost, even as a devotee, it can linger a little bit longer because there's some slight destiny involved there. But usually if you're walking past a cemetery, you know, and maybe your hands are dirty or something like that, and you happen to come back to the temple, he goes follow you back, which is, you know, not out of the question. Pretty much they'll go in a few minutes after chanting, you know.
So
if you
don't come back to the question, yeah.
That's a fact, yeah. No, it's a fact. People can become... you wouldn't expect, though, that someone who's been chanting Hare Krishna for many, many years would actually be suffering the effects of ghosts, generally, but there are some ghosts, known as Brahma Rakshasas and what have you, who are particularly powerful and who actually do almost try to disturb the activities of yogis and persons who try to control their mind and senses. There are some very, very powerful sattva beings like this who particularly harass sannyasis and what have you. It's a fact.
I thought I was thinking of the demons, obviously, that like to occupy the positions of, say, a private party member. So they'd like to get in there and do their thing, you know. So these are actually targets for these people. So, and also, if they're travelling around doing sannyasis, maybe they have a bit of stress because the travelling things is weakened.
There are some very famous stories in ISKCON of, you know, sannyasis, you know, being, you know, badly thrown across the room and all sorts of, you know, strange and, you know, wonderful things, you know, in certain parts of the world, you know, in, you know, Transylvania, you know, preaching in Bulgaria, is it, you know, some of those... very ancient parts, you know, where they, you know, the stories of werewolves and vampires originate from. Oh, yeah, there would definitely be in those days. So, goblins and hobgoblins. Many, many different stories in ISKCON about that, you know. Devotees in India, you know, sannyasis walking down the road. They bow down to pay their obeisances. When they look at the feet, they've got the feet of, you know, chickens. You know, like they're called jinns. Jinns, they have the human head, but some part of their body is like an animal. All sorts of weird things. Yes, a devotee takes bath, you know, they always keep themselves suci.
Then,
you take a bath, yeah. Yeah. When I go and do a cremation or, you know, a funeral, first thing I do is I come back, take bath. Change my clothes and, you know, put them in the wash and then, you know, chant Hare Krishna and then, you know, fresh clothes and, you know, that first thing before I do anything else in the day, as soon as I've come from a funeral, first thing I do. And you know, at a funeral place, I don't drink water, I don't eat foods, I don't, you know, I don't take anything into my mouth. Yes. You know, I don't, you know, go to the toilets and, you know, as far as possible.
So
these guys
would be more likely to hang around the crematoriums
and they're like a mecca, you know, they're like a capital city. Well, once you're haunted, you don't. No. No. Oh, yeah. That's called schizophrenia. Many forms of schizophrenia are actually people who are seriously haunted by several different personalities. Yes. Yeah, because, you know, there is a certain weakness as a result of the epilepsy of the mind and that, and it's just, that becomes just, you know, an entrance point. Very easy, you know. Door's wide open, you know. no locks on this door, boys.
No, I just recently went to Jagai Madhai Samadhi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you know, Jagai, yes, I said, I was a jewelry and before my champion Krishna. You know, paid amazing. So I actually felt like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's these are the Buddhas and the Pasachas, and you know, is it this you know, slothfulness is associated with people who, you know, very lazy in their habits. You know, so very lazy in hygiene. Very lazy, and, you know, they don't tidy up their bedroom, the kitchen. So that sloth is like lazy, dirty. You know, it's a little bit more than just lazy. It's slothful. You know, it's. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yes. All right. So now, Brahma, he evolved the ghosts and fiends. They were all naked. That meant for putting the conditioned souls in various miseries. They took possession of the body thrown off in the form of yawning by Brahma, the creator of living entities. So cover your mouth and you yawn. This is also known as the sleep which causes drooling. The hobgoblins and ghosts attack men who are impure, and their attack is spoken of as insanity, which is what I said. Now this is a sure sign to see that someone, while they're asleep, ghosts have entered. Is that while they sleep, they drool. No, it's a fact. While they sleep, drool comes out of their mouth onto the pillow. It's a particular type of sleep where one, the person's contaminated by drooling, and it sort of shows just almost a you know, even while we're asleep we have a certain amount of control over our body. But, you know, when that drooling is there, that control appears to be lost. And, you know, it can be a sign that, you know, unless they've got some other problem, but, you know, generally, it's a pretty good sign that, you know, a person is sort of being inhabited by someone while they're sleeping. So they may not be seriously haunted, and sometimes some people wake up, the ghosts go. They go to sleep, they come back. Some people, when they're seriously haunted, as is described with insanity, the ghosts just don't leave. Waking, sleeping, they're there.
And is this what drives them insane? Is the fact that there's some other force operating and they can't understand it?
Well,
so that makes them.
Prabhupada explains it that in you know, here and there, that what happens is they don't have, especially in his lectures, they don't have a gross body. Many of them. So there are many different types of pasastras, and some have some type of a subtle gross body to one degree or another, and some really don't have a gross body. They inhabit the bodies of persons who have a gross body because they do suffer from thirst and hunger and a lack of sensual pleasure because they don't have the gross body to fulfill their desires. So they actually inhabit someone's body and they enjoy things that they want in the mode of ignorance and passion. You know, those activities. And, you know, it's within their interest to keep that person in a weakened state through intoxication, through excessive sex life, because the more weak they are, the more they can stay there, you know. So they can bewilder them to, you know, do certain things. And, you know, there's many, many different things that they can work, you know. They can work with fear. They can work with, controlling the mind to some degree. You know, there's a lot of different ways that they do it, you know. Take control and keep persons in a and once a person is in a weak state, if that subtle being is very powerful, you know, and or sometimes there's more of them, and they keep that person doing all sorts of nonsense activities which disturb their body, and that then they it does produce insanity. Oh, many, you know, 30, 40, yeah. There are cases, you know, there are different cases.
Yeah.
Usually it's a couple, a few, like that. But, it's like, this is my cousin Joe, you know. It's, this is Casper, and, you know. It's like hitchhiking in the Western Australia, that some of the Aborigine people are like that. When I was a teenager, you're sitting there on the side of the road, and it's desert all around. You can't see anyone. All of a sudden, this person comes out of nowhere. Boy, you got a cigarette? And now the worst thing you can do is say yes. Anything. They go, you got a dollar. If you say yes, that's it. Because as soon as you pull out $1, all of a sudden his cousin Joe's just behind. Where'd he come from? Oh, you got a dollar. Can I have a dollar? Like this. And then, the next thing is, oh, you got a dollar. And then you're surrounded by about 50 of them, And then they're going through your rucksack, and you're trying to get that, and they're going through your other bag. That's about it. I've had that experience. It's a little bit like that, they just come out of nowhere. What's that? Yeah, they do. In fact, I had one experience, so desperate and degraded some of them are, is that one of the Aborigine persons said to me, he had a couple of children, about, probably a year, year and a half, 2 years old, completely naked, and this is at night, I'm hitchhiking at night. The kids have got no clothes on at all, being bitten by mosquitoes. And, he says to me, you give me a couple of dollars for a bottle of sherry, I'll give you this little child. Like that. Okay, what? Yeah, a couple of dollars, you can have this one. Like that. And actually, I saw that group in town. This is hitchhiking up West Australia. I saw that group in town. They were doing a ritual, and they had one Aborigine person tied up by ropes to a tree. They had his genitals tied up, and the women were, they had fire sticks and all, and they, all drinking, and it's just like a haven for ghosts and hobgoblins. That seriously. And just, it was just insane, the activities they were doing. But that's what happens when, they actually literally become insane and inhabited by ghosts in whole communities. Very sad. So, oh, yeah, you'd have to have the cooperation, yeah. But it's possible, basically, they would have to just associate with devotees over a long period of time, though, because, when ghosts, they can become very, once, if they get into a person's body and make them weak enough and slightly insane, they can hang on there, for a long time, even when there's all sorts of, you chant Hare Krishna, they go hide behind a tree, and you go to bed and they come straight back in. That's a fact. 24 hours a day for over a period of time, I think, was it Ramanujacharya who, he went to the tree and, I think it was over the course of 18 days or a month or something, and he was chanting and reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam. It wasn't just like, even a great acharya like that. Some of them are very powerful and they'll hang on, But if there's no stoppage, you just keep it up until they go and they leave. So, really, there's just the one or two verses left. We've pretty much got that. Now, recognize himself to be full of desire and energy, Brahma, evolved from his own invisible form from his navel, host of Sajjas and Pitas. Sajjas and Pitas, they're invisible forms of departed souls. Yes. The Pitas themselves took possession of the invisible body, the source of their existence. It is through the medium of this invisible body that these well-versed in the rituals, those well-versed in the rituals offer oblations to the Sajjas and Pitas on the occasion of Shraddha. Now this is a very interesting thing here. We see that here that Prabhupada says, what are the results of the Shraddha ceremony and do devotees need to perform it? Right. Now, because the Lord is pleased with the devotional service of the descendants, it liberates the condemned souls. I do a lot of Shraddhas. Do devotees need to do it? Devotee of the Lord, or one who is in Krishna consciousness, does not need to perform such ritualistic ceremonies as Shraddha. Right? Because he's always pleasing. They're automatically relieved of any difficulty of taking an unfortunate situation where they don't have a gross form as Sajjas or Pitas. They're departed souls who may not necessarily get a gross body, and they may also be suffering punishment. By the Shraddha, they're awarded relief from that situation and ultimately a body. Do devotees need to do it? No, because the devotees are performing devotional service which pleases the Lord, therefore therefore fathers are automatically delivered. Does that mean that the devotees never do Shraddha? No, devotees do Shraddha. Because actually what you'll find is that whatever ISKCON is maintaining of the Vedic culture, others follow. And whatever ISKCON doesn't maintain, others will lose. Basically, the Hindu culture, the Vedic culture, is in each successive family is being more and more diminished. So if they have no example, they will give up Shraddha. Now, from their position, though, for them to give up Shraddha means that they will not be able to deliver their forefathers. And therefore, they can be encouraged. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu performed Shraddha for his father. Advaita Acharya performed Shraddha. Yudhisthira Maharaj performed Shraddha. There are many famous devotees who perform Shraddha. They don't necessarily have to, but if they're in a position where others are going to follow them and those others need to perform them, better to do it. So devotees don't need to do it, but that doesn't mean that if you see a devotee doing a Shraddha, oh, what is this nonsense? Prabhupada says we don't have to do it. That's like saying, there are many aspects of Vedic culture which devotees don't need to follow. But we follow it because we want the people who are following us to at least follow that Vedic culture, because that's a platform for them becoming Krishna conscious. Yep. All right then. So we'll leave it there. So we got the Sajjas. Is that where are we? We can take up the rest next time. Next time we'll do chapter 21. We'll just cover these last few, in brief. You can make sure that you've read them. But next week we'll cover chapter 21 at that. And if you get a chance to read the other chapters, you should, because some of the students have actually chosen their chapter that they're going to do their individual presentation on. I'll pass around the sheet for attendance. Do you have a pen? Anyone got a pen there? And the other thing, I'm going to pass around the sheet. Now, those who were here last week, who chose a chapter, put your name down. I'll pass that one too, Amog. Because Chris, you chose one, didn't you? Yeah, so just those who were here last week, make sure they put their name down. Then those who weren't here last week, have a look at that list. if you know the chapter you want to do for your presentation, choose it, because there'll only be a maximum of 2 to 3 for each chapter. So once those 2 to 3 are on that list, you can't choose it. You have to choose another. So if there's one that you particularly like, then choose it. But or you can wait till next week. When you've therefore make sure you have at least a cursory look at the chapters, all of them. What's that? As soon as we finish the 5 chapters, as we're doing now, we'll do that. We'll then do an exam, and then we'll do a presentation. What's that? No. We'll do the presentation first, and then we'll do the exam after. 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. The 5 chapters. Anyone who didn't get their test results back, I have them. If you want to come up and see me.